Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mark Martin was clearly troubled from an early age. He caused problems in school and he admitted to admiring brutal serial killers. As he got older, his problematic behaviour only escalated. He'd been in trouble with the police and was reportedly fascinated by violence, in particular, violence towards women. Worryingly, where other young people grow up to aspire to be professionals and family men and women, he instead strove to become Nottingham's first serial killer, which was a feat he unfortunately ended up achieving. This is the case of Mark Martin. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case is one of those that just makes you consider that old age issue about whether it's nature, nurture, or a crossover of both. Because some people I genuinely believe are born bad. I'm not saying that's a huge amount statistically, and often there are variables and realities that you can look into the past of a killer and think, well, that would have contributed. But equally, so many people have difficult childhoods and they end up amazing humanitarians. So I genuinely feel that some individuals are born with a predisposition to kill. And Mark Martin, who we're going to be talking about today, exemplifies that perfectly, in my opinion. So who was Mark Martin? He was born on the 18th of October in 1979 in Ilkeston, Derbyshire. He was described as a very aggressive teenager when he was at school. And I think that that probably relates to the fact that he had been quite badly bullied. He had quite a distinctive birthmark below his left eye. And we all know that whatever your differences are, the reality is that at school, somebody will identify them. It's just the way that certain kids are. I am not saying that young people are cruel. I am saying that young people are still developing their level of conscience. They are still growing into the human beings and adults they will become. And inevitably, that means that sometimes they don't come across on their best behavior when it comes down to social experience. Kids will say things that are a bit mean, and like I said, that's not because they are bad or mean within, it's just that they are not yet cultivated in how to have appropriate etiquette in situations. And yes, there will always be people who carry on being bullies, but for the most part, a lot of us can look back at our histories and think, well, I really wish I hadn't said that on that particular occasion. But if you happen to be the recipient of that situation and you're the person being name called because you're different in some way, it is obviously going to make you feel a level of helplessness, a level of powerlessness, and it's going to really be frustrating. Also, without a doubt, it can cause rage. And if you haven't got the opportunity to express your rage in an appropriate manner, such as in hobbies like boxing or meditation, which will help you calm, etc., the chances are you're going to internalize it, and that has got the power to boil over at times. So Mark Martin has certain struggles. People are identifying him as a bit different. And I don't just think that's to do with the mark under his eye. I think it's because he's an odd character. I think he's one of those individuals where there is an air about him that people struggle to connect with. And as he grows up and becomes a little bit stronger, so he goes from being the child to the teen and becomes a little bit more sure of himself, that internalized rage that I was just talking about, it starts to boil over. And his friend said that he was genuinely a real troublemaker. When he got to high school, he would swear at teachers. He was often being thrown out of lessons. Other pupils at Ilkeston School also felt that his behaviour was just odd. Apparently he had a level of learning difficulty, and that would obviously be challenging because that means that you're going to be noted by your peers as having extra needs. And like I said, no one wants to be that kid. There's nothing wrong with being that kid. People have different developmental levels. People like me are dyslexic, for example. It means that when it comes down to things like maths where I'm dyscalculic, I don't have a clue. And it takes a lot of extra work for me to be able to actually do the maths that other people would just find quite simple. The same when it comes down to punctuation, which I do not believe exists. I'm not sure it's required. If I need to take a breath, I put a comma there. That's kind of how I work with those things. So what I'm saying is no one wants to be that kid because people notice you, but that is going to add to that level and layer that he has to manage. So the bullying is going to be because of that physical issue, but also it's going to be because of his character. And on top of that, because he stands out because of his special needs to some degree. But the person who was talking about that, and I was listening to an interview around who Mark Martin was at school, she was saying that in spite of that, and in spite of the fact that he was standing out for his actual learning issues, he didn't do himself any favours whatsoever. Because as opposed to towing the line and trying to get praise, he went out of his way to be challenging and problematic. Equally, from a psychological perspective, we understand that young people who are growing up, particularly if they've endured bullying, if they do have some special needs, because it makes them feel insecure, arguably, they will look for a place to have meaning and they will look for a place to stand out. And you can do that in a positive way or a negative way. And if it's impossible for you in an academic system to do that with your actual knowledge and academic ability, you may find other ways of standing out. And so it could be that Mark Martin is being challenging and problematic because he wants visibility. He wants people to actually acknowledge that he exists. And even though it's terrible attention, it's potentially better than no attention at all. People said that he was often asked to leave lessons and he didn't seem to have those boundaries with the teachers. He wouldn't have a problem with a confrontation. So he's quite confident and quick with this conflict. And apparently anything would set him off. So he had a very poor level of control about how he reacted. And again, when you think about adolescent young men, we know that certainly from the ages of 13 to 19 in particular, they do not interpret the world emotionally how they will do prior to that or after that. And that's because their brain is developing. Remember, it's forming all the way up until 25. And what research evidence is that a 13, 14, 15, 16, etc. year old young man will be emotionally less capable than he would have been at 10. Because other things are happening within his brain, within his emotions, within the whole physiology of his system that essentially means that he doesn't interpret the world accurately at times, particularly when it comes down to conflict. In research, they have done tests where basically you will show a young man of, say, 15, a set of images of faces, and they'll often think that the face is showing anger when the face is actually showing frustration or confusion. And because of that, it shows a reactiveness because they're misinterpreting the actual cue. And that's a problem, because if you look at somebody and they're actually confused and you see a need to be defensive and aggressive, that's going to mean that you're going to end up in more conflictual situations. And it's a spectrum. Some young men don't have that many issues doing it, and some have enormous issues. But it would be more problematic, as I said, to interpret other people than it would have been when they were young children, essentially. And one of the things that comes into play here is what hearsay suggests, because I can't say that I have absolute documented evidence on this, but what hearsay suggests is that he did have a very dysfunctional upbringing. His father was apparently very abusive and would often beat him with a walking stick, and his mother was apparently not very present or caring, to the point where he really noticed the difference between his friend's parents and his own. But like I said, it's not documented by any social care information, etc., or child services being involved. This is just things that have been said by people who knew him on reflection, looking back at his childhood. Now, when you think about your idols, I don't know, we all have idols, don't we? I'm going to be honest. I had idols like Jon Bon Jovi. I think it was because I wanted his hair. I'm going to throw it out there, guys. I don't understand, even to this day, why so many men are blessed with such luscious locks. It feels like women should be given those locks more than those particular soft rockers. But anyway, we all have our idols, don't we? I remember my sister had a picture of a guy called Adam Ant. If you're under the age of 40, you'll be like, who is that? Just take it from me. It was somebody that she liked. I also think he introduced me to black eyeliner because he looked great in it. We all have people that when we're growing up, we think, oh, I would like to be like them. I would aspire to have a lifestyle like them. But I don't know, where Mark Martin is concerned, they weren't, shall we say, the most likely. Not the typical heroes that are adored by all your friends as well, you know, where you all get together and are like, oh, I really like that great band. They're amazing. Yeah, I really like the band too. Yeah, we should definitely go and see them. That's kind of how it goes, as opposed to, so Mark, who are your idols? Ian Brady. Yeah, Ian Brady, Donald Nielsen, him as well. Black Panther, yeah. Generally, anybody who's done really heinous things, ideally to children, maybe women as well, because that's quite inspiring when they've done things to children and women. Okay, so just before you talk about the next person on your list, have we got any individuals who aren't necessarily locked up potentially for their entire lives, or are actually a full-time resident at a secure mental health facility for the criminally insane? No, they're all of a similar ilk, shall we say. Okay, kids, if you could just all move your tables to the side and we'll just remove ourselves from the classroom one by one, looking directly in Mark Martin's eyes as we retreat from said place. Honestly, that's the kind of idol that he had. And he actually told his friend Gareth that what he wanted for he and Gareth in the future was that they were going to become the equivalent of the Cray twins when they were older. So I imagine that his friend Gareth thought, well, that's something to look forward to. We'll just become part of the criminal underground and then eventually spend the rest of our lives in prison. Because that's exactly what happened where the Cray twins were concerned. But as you will note, I do not believe that we are dealing with an individual who is at this point joking. I genuinely think we're dealing with an individual who really is concerned about becoming notorious, has a main inclination psychologically to be seen and to be visible. And if he's not going to be visible for the right reasons, then my God, he's going to be visible for the wrong reasons. And that same friend, Gareth, who was obviously very close to him at the time, he said something that really unnerved him was that Mark was once really upset when he was listening to this baby crying. This is when he was a teenager. And he got so angry with this baby's cries that he literally tried to smother the baby. Now, Gareth prevented that from happening. Now, this kind of behavior is truly terrifying. We're talking about a teenager who in that moment was willing to kill a child to make that child be quiet. And when you think about the spectrum of vulnerability, there is nothing more vulnerable than a baby. They rely on us for their safety. They rely on us for everything protection orientated wise. And he does not care. He just wants it to be quiet. And the fact that Gareth has to literally step in to stop that happening that bodes very badly for Mark Martin's future. And it's also very evident at this point that Mark Martin does not know how to handle himself emotionally and is volatile and willing to use violence if he so believes he needs to in that moment. Also, like I said, it speaks to a particular mindset when he will literally harm the most vulnerable. And I think this whole case is based around just that. Mark Martin's love of harming those who have less, who are less able to protect themselves, who are less able to get the support they need, who are less visible to the world around them. And that's exactly why he goes with the victims that he chooses to kill in the case I'm talking about today. Now, when Mark reaches age 16, he has begun doing drugs. So he's taking speed, he's taking cannabis, he's got a criminal record now. And he and Gareth, who, as I said, he wants them to become Cray Twins Mark II, they're actually buying and selling cars at this point. And Gareth, again, reflected on the relationship that he had with Mark Martin and said that he saw some very disturbing realities about his character early on. So we've seen what happened with the baby, but on one occasion, when they're buying and selling together, they take a group of girls with them. And during that situation, Mark Martin actually becomes really verbally abusive and very violent towards the females. And that's another hallmark that we're going to explore today. Mark Martin does not fight with the peers. He is not interested in being violent towards another man. He's only interested in picking on individuals he can easily physically overcome, and that's women, full stop. So as a young teenager, he's more than happy to be abusive to females. Also, he's quite unique in his reactions to certain situations. So apparently, his father at some point was in prison. He was very proud that his father was surrounded by killers. When Mark's father actually dies, apparently he just simply laughed about it. He found it really funny. And on one level, if his father was very abusive, I understand that he probably wouldn't mourn his passing. It makes sense that he would be somebody who would feel a level of relief because the relationship was not a positive one. But if you lose somebody, even when they have been abusive, it's very rare that you would laugh about them dying. Because as a compassionate, empathic human being, it just isn't the reaction. You might, like I said, express absolute relief, but finding it funny is quite sadistic as a reaction. Now, as he gets older, his crime list gets longer because he's somebody who's quite happy to act in a criminal way. He's charged with burglary, he's charged with common assault, he's charged with threatening behavior, he's charged with possession of an offensive weapon and robbery. In spite of this list that I think would make him very unattractive as a prospect, he does manage to marry in his early 20s. And then in 2002, his wife was actually pregnant with his son. However, in spite of the fact that she is pregnant, this doesn't stop him from assaulting her. Now, we know that statistically, when you are pregnant, if you're in a domestically abusive relationship, that tends not to dampen down the violence. In fact, there is lots of research that evidences that it increases and amplifies the level of violence that the female in this situation experiences at the hands of the perpetrator who is meant to be her loving partner. But he follows suit in that respect, and he is violent towards her when she is pregnant. In one instance, he hit her and then he threatened her with a knife. Another time, he put his hands around her throat and tried to strangle her. So we're talking about a man who acted in a way that certainly indicates he had the potential to kill, and to kill a woman who he should be more protective of at this moment in time because she is pregnant. Now, in 2002, he actually writes a letter to his probation officer, and in that letter he says this: "I was so sweet and nice until my dad died, and now I'm evil. How long till I kill? It could be a lady, pets, anything." He also told his probation officer that he was in love with his wife and didn't want to end up losing her. Just gonna throw it out there, Mark. You have a very strange way of showing love. I don't think that threatening her with a knife or trying to strangle her is, you know, the most romantic gesture out there. Also, imagine being that probation officer. You've got an individual that no doubt you have grave concerns over anyway, confiding in you that they have this desire to kill. And they're not concerned about what they're going to kill. although animals and women make it on the list, but they are expressing that there is something within them that makes them want to act in this manner. Also interesting that he brings in the fact that he was really good and nice until his father died. You can look at that in lots of different ways, but for me personally, I would say that his father, he saw as the dominant party. His father was an individual with the power, and once he is gone, he's no longer afraid, and therefore he feels that he can follow suit, shall we say, inherit the position that his father used to hold, being an abusive perpetrator. In this case, when it comes down to Mark Martin, he actually graduates further than his own father did. But that, to me, is what shifts when his father dies. Of course, he could be using that as an excuse as well. So he's basically blaming what happened with his father dying as the reasoning behind why he becomes so violent and aggressive himself. So that therefore he's sidestepping taking accountability and responsibility for who he has grown into, who he has become. But it also suggests that he is aware of his real inherent aggression, that he's an individual who knows there is a rage within. And as I've said, he's already hurt his partner, so he isn't concerned about boundaries. It's not whether he wants to go out and hurt animals and ladies who are strangers or animals that have no relationship to him. He's quite happy to harm the person in his own home. We get to October 2004, and this is where Mark assaults his wife again, and he actually gets arrested as a result. She had a black right eye, bruising on her neck, and she had red marks on her nose, and she also had a cut lip. So he'd really gone for it. Now, after he's released for this assault, he reportedly called 999 the very next day and said that he'd just been in prison the night before for the attack on his wife, but now he was having some really very disturbing thoughts, and he feared that he might actually kill someone. That's absolutely horrifying. At the end of the day, if somebody is getting in contact with the emergency services and saying that they potentially are going to go ahead and kill someone, that's a huge safeguarding issue. And I would suggest that at that point, he should be taken probably to a mental health secure unit where he can be put into the care of the authority until they can figure out what needs to take place regarding managing whatever mental health issue he might be dealing with. Because if somebody is ringing up and saying, I have this potential and I'm thinking of acting on it, irrespective of how stretched resources are, that is something that could potentially mean that an individual dies. Now, you won't be surprised to know that not long after that assault on his wife, he and his wife separated. She was really worried about their son. She was very afraid that Mark Martin could fly so easily off the handle and do such damage. And he was apparently furious about this, but I suppose the saving grace is that he does move out without harming her, and he also doesn't harm his son either. So he has a lot of resentment, a lot of bitterness towards that situation, but at least he hasn't gone ahead and done something dreadful. And apparently after they split up, that resentment just increases because she genuinely didn't want him to have any access to their child. And I would salute and applaud and agree with that. I do appreciate that child protective services have, shall we say, different ideas about who is appropriate to be around kids. I know that they believe that if a man is violent towards a partner, often the children will still get to see the parent because it wasn't directly towards the kids. I would say, why would you let a man or a woman who is violent in a domestic setting be around children? Because they cannot defend themselves, they are more vulnerable, and the person has demonstrated that they have the capacity to be violent to a member of the family. But obviously, there are many professionals out there that disagree with my point of view. I would not ever allow my child to be around a violent ex. It's as simple as that, because at the end of the day, you could never feel safe unless they were in a supervised situation. And I understand that some people will have supervised access, but there are situations where violent partners who have been very, very aggressive in relationships do have access still to their children in an unsupervised way. And it has led to scenarios unfolding where children have been murdered. So it's not as if I'm just saying this because of my personal views, it's because history has taught us that those individuals can't be trusted. So I'm on board with his ex. I think she's making the right decision, thinking he shouldn't have access to his child. But you can also imagine that for somebody like Mark Martin, somebody having power and control over something that he wants is going to make him deeply revengeful and likely very resentful. And if he hasn't got a place to project that, i.e. he can't now be abusive towards his ex because she's not in that situation with him anymore, she's escaped, well, he's still got to manage all of that boiling anger and rage. And it feels as if that could be, again, another reason why he feels that he has a right to hurt the people that he chooses to hurt, because he feels that somebody is hurting him and he feels that somebody's got power over him. And so now he wants to have power over others and he wants to hurt other people. We get to December 2004, and at this point, I would say Mark Martin has done some really weird decision making. So he started living in a tent near some warehouses, and he started essentially wearing a mask of homelessness, I would say. So he's living amongst the homeless community in Nottingham, but he has a perfectly okay place to go himself. He has a place in Ilkeston to actually go home to, but it's as if he wants to fabricate being homeless, blend himself in. And I would personally say that's down to the fact that he's profiling his potential victims. He's made a decision that he wants to kill people, and he's thinking, where's the best place to kill people? Well, consider homelessness for a minute. Homeless people often don't have the same level of support in their lives. They don't often have really supportive frameworks family-wise where they can go home. Often they have things like dependency issues, alcoholism, drug dependency. That means that they're more likely to die. Also, when a homeless person turns up dead, is the same diligence applied when the bodies are found as a body that was found in a nice home would be treated by the emergency responders, and so on and so forth. So if you want to kill, find a victim who is going to be more vulnerable and more easy to access, but is also going to be seen potentially as less worthy. And I don't mean that they aren't worthy, they absolutely 100% are. It disgusts me that people like sex workers and homeless individuals seem to get less care and attention when cases are investigated. And I'm not saying that happens all the time. In this case, it's not true. You know, they take great care about these individuals. But we see it time and time again where victims are concerned. So it would be unsurprising if Mark Martin had decided on his victims, i.e. homeless people. He recognises that they're going to be more vulnerable. He also notes that there might be less publicity around their bodies turning up. And now he's immersing himself within the lifestyle to find appropriate candidates that he thinks he could kill and get away with killing. Because like I said, he's not homeless at all. He can go home anytime he wants. And he really does wear the mask of homelessness. So he's eating at soup kitchens. He's frequenting the local haunts of other homeless people. And an outreach worker who was in the local area who worked with homeless people, they described Mark as a really intimidating person who just always did what he liked. He's quite physically dominant. He's a big guy. And another worker referred to him as being known to be a psychopath and also a very dangerous person who needed to be closely observed. It was noted by those people who were homeless and were around him that he was really happy to bully other homeless people. He'd take their benefits from them. He'd take belongings from them. He'd rob them. He'd resort to violence to do that, aggression to do that. Now, just put that into context. This is a man who has a home to go to. This is a man who has money that he can access. And yet here he is exploiting individuals who have nothing, have absolutely nothing. They're begging on the streets, and most of the time they're doing that because they need to buy drinks, because they're alcoholics, or drugs, because they're dependents. And so he is taking from those who have literally nothing. And if you want to be the most brutal type of bully, find the most vulnerable individuals and absolutely decimate them, because essentially, you genuinely can exert that level of power over an individual who doesn't have the resources and support network around them that can protect them from you. And he knows that. So he's taken from the least privileged in society when he is, without a doubt, better off than them. He gained a name and reputation in the community because people were really afraid of him, and he was actually referred to as Reds. And a homeless person said that if you heard that Reds was on the side of town that you were, you would go to the other. Also, at this point, he's spending his time with dependents. So the people he's hanging out with, they are drug dependents and alcoholics, but he's not using drugs. He's not abusing alcohol. So he'd be seen occasionally having a can of lager, for example, but he doesn't have a problem with it. He's not an addict, but he's surrounding himself with addicts. And again, why would he be doing that? He's going to be doing that because he's checking out who is the most vulnerable, who's likely to be missed. Think about what he's going to be conversing with those individuals over. He's going to be asking them questions about their life. He's going to be asking them questions about the family. He's going to be figuring out who would be missed. And the sad truth is this: homeless people die and no one knows who they are. Literally. So he's aware that there will be a certain amount of individuals who fit that category. And it's probably quite alluring to him to imagine that he could dispose of somebody that he believes society sees as disposable, which is so dreadful, isn't it? It's a terrible indictment of our society. Now, his main preference, according to those around him, was that he would go for the ones who were really afflicted by alcohol and drug use. So he sought them out. He was described by people who had any connection with him whatsoever as being deeply manipulative, highly intimidating. And one of the reasons, like I said, he will be picking those people is it's going to be easier to bully them. It's going to be easier to coerce them, because if you're dependent on substances, let's be honest, somebody offers you a few cigarettes, somebody offers you make a quick buck doing a certain thing, you're going to say yes because you're going to be desperate to get that cash or desperate to get whatever it is they're offering you. And you're going to do it at a much cheaper rate than somebody who was in a situation where they had a privilege of a home, for example, and some benefits coming in, which many homeless people don't have access to. So he's going for those individuals that he can bully and he can coerce, but also he's going for them, like I said, because I think he is genuinely creating the pen portrait of his perfect victim. Those in the homeless community also said he was a real enigma. He was well presented. He didn't appear to be homeless, but he was living in a tent at times. So it was confusing, because that's not how people are on the streets. People aren't, on the whole, choosing that life. I appreciate there are a certain minority amount of individuals who genuinely can't deal with general day-to-day living as you or I would do. And homelessness is an actual choice, but it's rare. For most people, it's been some horrible things that have afflicted their life. They've ended up in a situation where they literally cannot keep paying rent. They end up homeless and so on and so forth. And they end up in pretty dire straits. And he's going specifically for those who have the biggest problems on the streets. Now, it's during this period where Mark Martin has voluntarily joined the homelessness community, in spite of the fact that he's got a perfectly reasonable place to go and live, that a burnt body is discovered in a squat in Marple Square. This is January the 24th, 2005. So emergency services had actually attended the scene initially, because the flat had been set alight. And once they managed to put the blaze out that they knew instantly had been set on fire on purpose, they discovered a gruesome scene when they found the body inside. Now, investigators quickly identified the deceased as 25-year-old Ellen Frith. And it doesn't take long for them to hear the name Mark Martin as a potential suspect being dropped into conversation. And the reason for that is Mark Martin had apparently been bragging to other homeless people that he'd murdered Ellen. And understandably, the homeless community is full of people with consciences. It's full of individuals who might have had some really challenging times and may have found themselves in difficult circumstances, but they're good, moral human beings. So when he's telling them that he's murdered this poor, defenseless woman, they're quick to inform the police about this. And we can look at Mark Martin talking about murdering Ellen with different frames. So number one is the obvious. He's super proud of it. He wants everybody to know. He wants to be seen. He wants to be caught. He wants the notoriety of being a brutal, cold, calculated killer. That's one level. But the other is that Mark Martin is so superior, so arrogant, so unaware that Ellen Frith had value, not just to her family, but to the homeless community, that he just feels that he'll be able to tell people and they won't care about Ellen Frith. And also, no one will notice that she's died and the police won't be concerned about her being found in this situation. And that at the end of the day, he's all powerful and dominant in the homeless community and people are scared of him, so nobody's actually going to speak to the police. So it could be on one level he wants the police to know that he's the person responsible, but it's in my mind more likely that he genuinely does not comprehend the fact that Ellen Frith will have had meaning. And so he doesn't think that anybody is actually going to speak to the police about what he's admitted. So the police have got this information being passed on, and actually it's not just one person, it's three people of interest are arrested in relation to Ellen's murder, because it's three individuals' names who've been put forward by people who have heard what Mark Martin and co have done. That's Mark Martin, John Ashley and Dean Carr. And what is truly terrible about this case is that, yes, Ellen Frith is discovered, but she wasn't the first victim. In fact, police are alerted at this point that there is a possibility he may have murdered others, because there are lots of rumours circulating around the homeless community. And even more disturbing for the police is when they realise that there are indeed at least another two homeless women who've disappeared. So these women were 26-year-old Zoe Pennick and 18-year-old Katie Baxter. So at this point, the police start to think that there is a possibility that he has killed them. But of course, before they can actually come to that conclusion, they have to initially look for Katie and look for Zoe. Is it possible, because they're in a transient community, that these rumours are untrue and that they are simply elsewhere? Does anybody have any information that, should they have been murdered, can lead to them at least being returned to their families by actually finding their bodies? It turned out that neither of the women had been seen in over a month, so the police are now really concerned about their whereabouts. Katie had last been seen by her family. She was leaving a party that had been held at her sister's house on December the 29th in 2004. She also was somebody who would always attend ice hockey matches to support the Nottingham Panthers with her family, and she missed a few of those games, so they were very concerned because that was completely out of character. And Zoe's last known communication was on January the 1st, 2005. Her father had last seen her in December, and he actually was the person who reported her missing, and he said that he had this horrible feeling that something truly terrible had happened to her, and very sadly, he was correct. Because on February the 11th, 2005, the police ended up having a really promising lead in their search. So they were advised to go to a disused warehouse near the centre of Nottingham. And this is also somewhere that had been identified as somewhere the girls had reportedly frequented. It was a place that local homeless people used as a shelter. And Mark Martin was also known to visit there. Now, when the police scoured the area with dogs, they made a horrific and very grisly discovery. Under some rubble, they uncovered the body of Katie, and Katie's body had actually started to decompose there. So a very distressing sight, both for the investigators, but also for her family to have to comprehend. Then just a few days later, in fact, on February the 16th, Zoe's body was found literally meters away from where Katie's had been. She again had just been covered by bricks and rubble, and she was in an advanced state of decomposition. So it was determined that Katie and Zoe had both been killed between the 30th of December 2004 and the 6th of January 2005, so in very quick succession. Now, at Ellen's death, that was estimated to have occurred in 2005, between January the 23rd and January the 25th. But still, we're talking about three deaths in a very short period of time. When the autopsy results came back on the bodies, they revealed that all three women had been strangled, so they'd all been murdered the same way. And that demonstrates the MO, doesn't it? A a person choosing to kill in a particular way. Also, when you think about what Mark Martin did with his pregnant partner, he put his hands around her throat. So this is an individual that we already know has this kind of assault weaponry within his nature. So Mark at this point is charged with the three murders. John Ashley, he was actually charged with two murders, so the murder of Ellen Frith and Katie Baxter. And Dean Carr, he was charged with one of the murders, that of Ellen Frith. Now, whilst the investigators agreed that Mark was the actual ringleader, when it came down to it, Ashley and Dean had helped him to murder the women. So they are culpable, it's as simple as that. It doesn't matter who is leading, the point is it takes followers often to get certain things done, and those followers are just as culpable as the individual instructing them. Although I do appreciate that some people will say, well, psychologically, those men may have been absolutely terrified of Mark Martin and may have just wanted to do his bidding and therefore protect themselves. But equally, just go to the police station and say, this guy is killing women. They'll get it sorted and you won't have to worry about that person being on the street anymore. I imagine that whilst Ashley and Dean were scared of him, there was also some benefits to being around him. People respected them. He was probably giving them a little bit of money, gave them access to things that they wanted, like alcohol, etc. And so it was useful for them to have Mark Martin around, be on his side, as opposed to on the other side that could bring them danger and wouldn't give them the perks that they were likely receiving. Now, there's another prisoner in this particular case, a guy called Scott Sinclair. Scott Sinclair, in my opinion, is a hero because we all know how difficult it is to be an informant when you are inside. It can make life in prison very difficult for you, and you often don't get that many benefits from talking to the police about what another individual has been telling you. But this particular prisoner, Scott Sinclair, is obviously deeply disturbed around Mark Martin. And he said that he'd been talking to him about his crimes, which I think was relatively traumatizing for Scott. So Scott said that Mark said, if I've killed one, I might as well kill 21. And that is absolutely how a serial killer would think. If you've killed one, you might get a life sentence. So why not kill 21? Because then you've enabled yourself to go through and live your fantasies out. And when you're caught, well, you're still going to be going down as you may have gone down with that first murder. And that logic is a permission base for somebody like Mark Martin to continue killing. Now, Mark Martin refused to actually speak to the investigators about what he'd done to the women he murdered. So the account from Scott was actually really important because it would lead investigators to understand exactly how those women died. So whilst Mark Martin was awaiting trial, there were a few things happening in the fact that this information is being passed to the police, but also he's writing to his childhood friend. So this is in April 2005. Gareth, who I talked about earlier on, who he wanted to be one of the Cray Twins Mark II with, received the letter. And the letter, which had been handed over to detectives, was from Martin, who was in Wakefield prison at the time. And he said, I've been charged with three murders and I'm just waiting to go on trial. I can't believe I'm in jail for murder and three of them as well. Ha ha ha. Oh dear. Ha. Yeah, it's a mess, boy. Hey, pal, but I'll get over it. He then apparently drew a smiley face. He said, I was all over the news. That tells you all you need to know about Mark Martin. He is not concerned about being in prison for murder. He's just thrilled that people are talking about him. He's thrilled that people are knowing his name. He's excited by it. He's thrilled by it. He's even boasting to his friend about it. He has none of the conscience or none of the regret that we'd expect when somebody's had their freedom removed, because it's more important to him to feed that ego, and that ego needs feeding with the knowledge that people are talking about him and talking about the heinous crimes that he has committed. He hasn't got a shred of concern over the lives that he's stolen. He also went on to talk about his dysfunctional childhood. He said in the letter, I'm big now, I've been doing steroids, I'm not thin anymore. Remember the school days when we used to get into loads of trouble? Haha. What about the time we ran away from home and your mum came and got us? I used to wish I had a mum like yours. So again, that introduces us to the fact that there was a sense of longing to some degree where Mark Martin is concerned. He was comparing his own mother to his friend's mother and realising that she fell short. But none of that's an excuse to act in the way that we're describing when it comes down to Mark Martin's actions. Gareth also said that he was really disturbed by the letter because it kept writing the number 10 with a big circle around it. And he felt like he was trying to tell him something. He said he wanted me to send 10 photos of me. And what Gareth genuinely thought he was saying was that he had potentially killed 10 people. He also said that the number 3 was also in a circle, referring to the women that he killed. So in his mind, he's thinking, is Mark Martin actually indicating, yes, he's been caught for 3, he's circled that, he's acknowledged it, but actually there is a number 10 that's circled constantly and referred to. And that made him feel really disconcerted, because we know serial killers really like to talk about what they've done. And for someone like Mark Martin, who hadn't willingly spoken to the police about his crimes, that wouldn't mean that he wouldn't want to discuss them. So it could be that he is indeed speaking in code to his own friend. The trial takes place in January 2006. At this trial, Scott Sinclair, he actually testified in court to explain exactly what Mark had told him about the murders. Understandably, he took a little bit of convincing to go and be the person who was going to testify against serial killer Mark Martin, because clearly Mark Martin is not somebody that you're going to end up sharing a cell with after you'd told the world about what he'd confided in you. And for somebody who's in a situation where they're in prison and they're essentially snitching on somebody in prison, it can put them in a really tenuous situation, without a doubt. And I think that Scott Sinclair is very brave, because personally, I would have been like, I'm happy to go and give this testimony, but I will actually require my own suite in prison. And I will want Just Eat on demand, so I can order my takeaways, and a massage 7 times a week. That kind of thing. I'd be cutting some kind of deal where I wouldn't have to be around the other inmates, and where my life got invariably better because of what I was telling the court. That obviously didn't happen. It would happen in my fantasy, should I ever end up in such a circumstance and situation. But he goes ahead. He's scared of Mark Martin. He's obviously intimidated by him, but he wants to tell the court the truth about what he had been informed of by Martin. And in doing that, he's standing up for the victims. It's as simple as that. So Scott Sinclair talked about the fact that Katie Baxter had been Mark's first victim. Apparently he'd met Katie in the centre of Nottingham, and she'd gone back with him to the warehouse where his tent was located. She thought they were friends. In fact, what's even sadder is that she reportedly had a crush on Mark, and so she went there willingly. She probably went there hopefully, and my God, she couldn't have got it more wrong. But again, it demonstrates the kind of manipulation that Mark Martin would have used. He would clearly have made her felt like she was somebody that he saw as attractive. He would have probably promised her things if she went back with him, and he's enticed her into this web, and that's how ultimately he gets to kill her. So once she goes inside his tent, he strangles her. Apparently she had fought hard, and she managed to scratch him quite a bit as well. In fact, that was something that concerned him, because he thought that might link him to her murder. And he was that worried about the forensic detail that she could have underneath her fingertips, he actually burnt her fingers in an attempt to destroy the evidence. He then buried her close by. Katie had actually previously been in a relationship with John Ashley, one of his co-conspirators, and it's likely that's where the link with Mark Martin had arrived. And her father actually said that he had assaulted her in December of 2004, and that after John Ashley had assaulted her, she'd actually had to attend hospital to receive stitches in her face as a result. So John Ashley was a violent bully as well, and a predator, clearly. But it's interesting that that was probably something that Mark Martin liked. The fact that she had those vulnerabilities, the fact that a man had been able to exert that kind of power over her, that probably made her a very attractive proposition to him, because she was deeply vulnerable in his eyes. Now, around a week after he's killed Katie, Mark Martin brings Zoe Pennick back to his tent, this time Basically, he'd promised her that he had a large number of cigarettes, and he said that he needed some help shifting them. He wanted her to sell them for him, so she'd agreed to do that. She's going to be able to make some money and be able to smoke a few of those fags herself, no doubt. So she goes there of her own volition, completely unaware that she is literally walking to her death. And as soon as he gets in the tent with her, he starts to strangle her. Again, apparently, Mark tells Scott Sinclair that Zoe really put up a fight. He even commented to him, she didn't want to die. You're like, don't think that's even required. It's going to throw it out there, Mark. This is why I would be terrible in these circumstances, because I would just have a list of questions about what that comment was like. Sorry, Mark. She didn't want to die. No, she did not want to die. How many people do you know actually want to be murdered? How are you saying it like that? It seems less rational of me to suggest that she struggled with the idea that she was dying. It does, doesn't it, Mark? It does. It sounds a little bit like you're a cold-blooded psychopath of the highest degree. But this is what he says to Scott Sinclair, that she didn't want to die. Of course she didn't. She didn't want to be murdered by a psychopathic lunatic. So he said that it had actually been really difficult to kill her, which is just horrible to imagine that there she is in that situation fighting for her life. And because she's fighting so hard, the brutality is even more horrific. So when he's killing her, he has to punch her. He has to kick her and she's not going down. So eventually he has to stand on her throat to cut off her air supply. And that's how he kills her. But he then told Scott Sinclair that he went on to smash her legs like biscuits. Just grotesque. To use that comparison, it just demonstrates how much of an object she is to him. She's not a human being. Zoe isn't somebody of meaning. She's somebody that he can be literally broken like biscuits and he gets great enjoyment out of it. Apparently he said he was sick on her because she wet herself whilst he was strangling her. And as we know, it's very common to urinate when you are in a terrifying situation. And also when you are dying, your muscles relax. But apparently he found that gross and was sick on her. He had just brutally murdered this woman. But what upsets him is the fact that she wets herself. That bothers him. I mean, of a spectrum of that doesn't make sense, that's right at the top. Also, he said that the reason that he selected Zoe as one of his victims was that she'd apparently left a bloody syringe in his bed. So that was why he felt he had a permission base to kill her. Just going to throw it out there, clutching at straws for a description and reasoning behind why you've murdered somebody. I mean, when you're thinking about an appropriate retaliation level, somebody leaving a bloody syringe in your bed is really not licensed for you to murder them. And obviously what we're seeing there is minimization. What he's saying to Scott Sinclair is, well, you know, there was a reason. I didn't just select this woman because she was deeply vulnerable and it was easy to coerce her back to my tent where I had planned on murdering her in a brutal fashion. He's saying, well, you know, I could have murdered other people, but she was deserving because she'd actually done something in my mind that I thought was wrong, which is she'd left that bloody syringe. But it's irrelevant. That's not the reason at all, if there even was a bloody syringe in his bed ever. The point is he's just minimizing. He's saying that there was some reasoning behind his actions and that she was deserving to some level because she had failed, I don't know, to act accordingly to the rules that she never knew he expected her to act within. But this is how he feels these individuals deserve to be treated, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a serious misogyny level, and we're talking about a view that he has of homeless people and how that lends itself to feeling that they are more deserving of being murdered than people who are potentially living in houses. It's again the accountability and minimization of his accountability because of that mindset that he holds about this particular community. Just going to throw it out there, clutching at straws for a description and reasoning behind why you've murdered somebody. I mean, when you're thinking about an appropriate retaliation level, somebody leaving a bloody syringe in your bed is really not licensed for you to murder them. And obviously what we're seeing there is minimization. What he's saying to Scott Sinclair is, well, you know, there was a reason. I didn't just select this woman because she was deeply vulnerable and it was easy to coerce her back to my tent where I had planned on murdering her in a brutal fashion. He's saying, well, you know, I could have murdered other people, but she was deserving because she'd actually done something in my mind that I thought was wrong, which is she'd left that bloody syringe. But it's irrelevant. That's not the reason at all, if there even was a bloody syringe in his bed ever. The point is, he's just minimising. He's saying that there was some reasoning behind his actions and that she was deserving to some level because she had failed, I don't know, to act accordingly to the rules that she never knew he expected her to act within. But this is how he feels these individuals deserve to be treated, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a serious misogyny level, and we're talking about a view that he has of homeless people and how that lends itself to feeling that they are more deserving of being murdered than people who are potentially living in houses. It's again the accountability and minimization of his accountability because of that mindset that he holds about this particular community. Scott Sinclair then talked about how Ellen had been killed. He said that she was killed in the squat on Marple Square. That was obviously where her body was found. And she'd apparently gone there with two men with the intention of taking drugs. Allegedly, there had been an argument at some point in the past with her and Mark Martin with relation to drug money. So there had been some kind of residual conflict. But clearly, if she was going to that squat, she obviously wasn't thinking that there was any problem between her and him. Mark Martin apparently attacked her in the kitchen, and the reason for that is she had started to eat an apple. Like I said, we are literally grabbling around for reasoning as to why he had a right to harm her, and that's what he's come up with. She's started to eat an apple. So this is when he tightened his hands around her neck. She becomes unconscious at that point. And then he actually says to John, finish the job. And he does. So he actually goes and finalises the murder, so to speak. Then Mark and John placed her on a sofa bed and they set fire to her. Mark also placed a needle in her hand and then stuck it in her leg. We presume that that's because he wanted to make her death look like an overdose, which makes no sense, because while she could have died of an overdose, one imagines the arson was not something she would be capable of after she was dead. You know, her ghost would not have been around sorting out a few fires in the locality to disguise the scene. So it's a ridiculous and redundant action. But again, it speaks of Mark Martin's arrogance and superiority. Oh, the investigators aren't going to even look at this diligently. They're just going to accept that this is another junkie who has died. Why bother actually considering that she might have been a human being of incalculable meaning to this world? Instead, they'll just wrap her up in a body bag, take her away, job done. Genuinely, that's how he will think about this woman. Also, Ellen apparently had not let Mark borrow £10 from her, which ultimately was something that he would have been very upset by. And again, that gives him motive as far as he is concerned for her murder. And we can all agree, can't we? Well, when it comes down to reasons for murder, there's not a lot that it takes to push you into that realm, Mark, is there? You know, he's looking for victims and thinking about any permission base possible to go ahead to fulfill his wish of basically becoming a serial killer. That's his motivation. His motivation is those extra numbers and finding any random reason to go ahead and kill, and doing that very effectively. Whether you've been eating an apple wrong, whether you owed him a bit of money, whether you went back to his tent to sell cigarettes, but you didn't know that in the background you'd annoyed him, even though you weren't potentially aware of any of that. These are all reasons why this man believes that he has a right to kill you. Also, other homeless people actually came and testified that Mark had bragged about the murders. So that community that he genuinely felt didn't lightly care about one another, he was wrong there. That community who, yes, had vulnerabilities, but were not disposable, as he believed, because they stepped forward and spoke up for one of their own who had been harmed. He got every single facet of viewpoint and perceptions regarding that community itself wrong. As much as he managed to enlist the help of two other homeless men to do his work with him, the reality is he had such a disregard for the homeless community that he didn't notice that the reason that they were a community was because they had learned to stick together. He may have seen them as worthless, disposable, as not having the same level of value as people like you or I may. But he got that completely wrong. Those individuals stuck together because they needed to for their own protection. And that meant that these individuals who disappeared were noticed. They were missed. Not only by the families, because the families cared too. This idea that they don't have any support, it's not true. These women did. So ultimately, it was his own arrogance about the meaning these people had in the world and in their world versus the meaning that he believed they had in his world. So yes, to him, they were disposable. Yes, to him, they were worth nothing. Less than nothing, in fact. They were okay to be brutalized and discarded and disregarded, to be left under rubble so the bodies could decompose, so the families couldn't say goodbye to them. That, for him, was something that was acceptable. But he didn't count on the fact that many, many others would find those actions reprehensible, and that so many others would deeply care and miss the women that he'd killed. So people from the homeless community had literally testified that Mark had bragged about the murders. He was proud of them. You will be unsurprised to hear, therefore, that the jury found all the three men guilty on all charges. So we get to February 2006, and this is when the sentencing hearing takes place. And Mark Martin received a whole life order. That means he ain't never going to be walking the streets. His crimes were considered so severe that he should never be released. So kind of quite similar to Ian Brady, you know, the person he aspired to be like, he died inside as well. Dean was sentenced to 14 years in prison. So Dean Carr got 14 years, and John Ashley was actually sentenced to 25 years in prison. It's interesting because when it came down to John Ashley and Dean Carr, they had very different suggestions as to what played out in the Ellen Frith murder. So John Ashley, he basically said that Mark Martin was the person who was fully responsible, that neither he nor Dean Carr had anything to do with it, whereas Dean Carr suggested that John Ashley and Mark Martin were the people who murdered her. So he pinpointed both of those individuals. Interesting to see that John Ashley decided that he was going to put all the blame on Mark Martin, because clearly he was guilty, but he didn't implicate Dean Carr. And that suggests that he certainly was more afraid of Mark Martin than Dean Carr, and that ultimately there was some level of conscience, because he could have tried to pin it on Carr as well, and he didn't. He pinned it directly onto Mark Martin. And I believe that's because John Ashley was absolutely culpable and deserves everything that he got, but arguably he sees the main antagonist as Mark Martin. The person who was leading, the person who was demanding, the person who was instructing was Mark Martin. Now, when it came down to sentencing remarks, Mr. Justice Butterfield said that the facts of these crimes are so horrific and the level of offending is so serious, you must be kept in prison for the rest of your life. You positively enjoyed killing, taking the wholly innocent lives of these three young women for your own perverted gratification. You've not shown a moment of remorse. You've reveled in what you did, glorifying the macabre details of these senseless, brutal, and callous killings. Very well said, and something that each and every one of us, without doubt, reflects when we hear this horrific story. Detective Superintendent Kevin Flint said that it was genuinely a relief that Mark had been caught, as it was highly likely that he would have killed again. And who knows, he may well have killed more than those we know of. Katie's parents, Glenys and Stephen, they said that they are doing that work to try to come to terms with her murder. They said, it's hard to believe that we'll never see her again. No parent should have to suffer the loss of a child, especially in such horrific circumstances. When it came down to the descriptions of Katie, people said that she was lovely, she was happy, she still had a really good relationship with her family, despite the fact that she actively chose to live on the streets. Ellen, well, she was somebody who had previously had some mental health issues. She'd suffered from cannabis psychosis, and she'd actually left her home after hearing voices, and she became quite paranoid that her parents were going to kill her because of that. Now, her father did try on multiple occasions to get her off the drugs, but obviously was unsuccessful. Zoe's dad, Kevin, he said that she knew she always had a home with him, but she elected for the homeless lifestyle. And he said, the pain of losing my little girl in such a brutal way will always remain with me. He described her as a bright, bubbly and generous person. He said that she loved to dance, she loved to sing. She had two children, so she was a mother, her first in 1996 and a second in 2002. And Kevin, her father, actually applied for compensation because that compensation would have meant that £11,000 could have been put in a trust fund and that could have been used for her children. It would have been through the Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority. However, sadly, this was denied as Zoe had a criminal record. So it was determined that due to this, an award of compensation would be inappropriate. Why? Why would it be inappropriate? Are we actually listening to this with any kind of compassion or logic? Because the children are the victims. The argument there that because their mother, who was brutally murdered by a serial killer, she had a criminal past, therefore she was not deemed worthy. The payment wasn't appropriate because she had been criminalized. That's the argument for not allowing her innocent children, who will grow up knowing that the mother was murdered by this heinous individual, by this monster, and yet she wasn't entitled to £11,000. I mean, it's negligible anyway, but to suggest for one second that just because she had some kind of criminal past, she was not worthy of that payment, that's disgraceful. That's not how life should be measured. People have problems. People do things that they regret. And we're not talking, where Zoe is concerned, of having some kind of malignant and malevolent past. We're talking about somebody with issues who had the obvious things like shoplifting, etc. Now, because of that, her children are denied any kind of support. And what's really tragic is that 12 years after Zoe's death, her brother was also murdered. He got horrifically stabbed to death by a new housemate who'd apparently suffered from a mental health episode and also clearly had the predisposition to be very violent. So their family has been decimated by murder, but Criminal Injuries didn't see it as fit to pay out so that two children may be given a little bit of help as they grow up. But then often we know there is very little justice in this world, particularly when we consider the fact that the people who were murdered in this case were already to some degree victims, victims of dependency, victims of some choices that they made because of their vulnerabilities, victims of being seen as individuals who were disposable by a man who believed that he had the right to take because it was what he wanted, and therefore he was justified in such actions. Mark Martin was somebody who struggled at times. He was somebody who had problems at times, but none of his past gave us any indication that he could ever amount to the kind of killer that we're talking about right now, today. So I go back to what I said at the very beginning of this particular case, that there is nothing when you look at his past that is so overwhelmingly brutal and tragic that you can envisage it would graduate to an individual feeling such rage, such resentment, such bitterness to society that he decided to carry out these killings in retribution for the way that he felt let down by society, by his peers, by his parents. And that's why I truly believe that some individuals genuinely are born bad. And wow, Mark Martin, I think he has rottenness running through each and every vein in his body. Every cell is evil. And he managed to do what he wished to do, which was to become notorious, to become known as a serial killer, and forever to have that link in history that he was the person who went out and murdered three innocent, vulnerable, homeless women. That he took pride in that. But these days, I imagine that he has a lot of time to think about the reality of who has the power now. Because, yeah, those women, they had their lives robbed, stolen. It's horrendous what happened to them and to their families. But they're the ones with the power now. Because every time his cell is locked, they're closing the door. Every time he's in a situation in prison where he no doubt will engage in altercations because other prisoners don't like lady killers, it's those women who will be applying the blows. Every time a screw looks at him with disrespect, it's their glare that's doing that. They are his lock. They are his key. They are his cell. They are his chains to that system till he takes his very last breath. And when he is ejected from that environment, when he takes that last breath, it will be those women driving him to the crematorium and seeing him in flames, albeit metaphorically. They are the individuals who sent him down for life. And therefore, even though he stole their lives, they're the ones in control now. And that makes me feel not that justice has been served, but that hopefully he will know that. He will know that that power he had, it was so short-lived. Whereas essentially for him, it's eternal, and they're the ones in control. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.